everyone. Welcome back to the Quantum Heart Cafe. It's a show where if you're not familiar with it already, if this is your first time coming to the cafe, it's a show where I talk about books, stories, and I relate the content in those books and stories to current events, but the type of current events that people aren't really talking about in the mainstream news or even the alternative media. This is a place where I try and share my thoughts and ideas and so on about just the material that I've been studying and the material that I've been learning about. And it's usually mostly to do with like metaphysics or really cool stories with metaphysic type topic or themes in them, like Madeleine Ingalls' Time, Wrinkle in Time and her quintet series, or Michael Ende and his book The Neverending Story, or I did The Night of Wishes. So, you know, usually children's authors, they have books that have really important metaphysical concepts tucked away in the stories, and so I always find it interesting reading them. So I generally share those two, or just books. Like right now I'm I'm trying to finish up the book Beyond the Box, which is about B.F. Skinner's work on token economics. So I have a range of topics that I like to focus on and research, and maybe as the show goes on I'll, you know, pick a area to kind of focus on a bit more. But for now, my focus is mostly on like metaphysics and spirituality, but then relating those to current events, and then also just, you know, sharing my own personal thoughts and my own spiritual growth and spiritual journey in hopes that maybe you find it helpful. And it's the spirit of a cafe because during, you know, for the last few years during the lockdown and stuff like that, you know, like most of the cafes were closed to me, so I decided to take the cafe on the road and just kind of, you know, maybe do the spirit of a cafe in a podcast. And so, you know, I have a nice cup of coffee. It's decaf coffee because I'm don't want to be up all night, but you know, I enjoy a little bit of coffee or tea or sometimes even just warm water while I'm doing the show, just to, because for me, like, cafes have always been a great place to go read, you know, socialize with friends, talk about ideas and discuss topics, and just to relax. And, you know, they're probably one of my favorite spots to go to is a nice cafe and a nice bookstore. Like, those are my two favorite stomping grounds wherever I go. And so I just want to put that in the spirit of a cafe. And usually before I start a show, or before I get into the meat and potatoes of a show, I like to also give a moment of gratitude. And so for this week, my moment of gratitude is, now that spring is coming around, I've noticed that the birds in the morning, they're just out there singing their songs. It's lovely. Like, they usually, you know, sing their songs and stuff in the winter time, but it does feel like there's a different rhythm, like there's a different energy now that everything is renewing itself, and we're heading into the new astrological season, with the season Aries season coming around and finishing off with Pisces. So there's this like energy of renewal and you know, just nice, like kind of a nice break from the winter and the reflective sort of moments that the winter brings towards now some, you know, maybe some growth and new life, new ideas and so on. So it's just a really nice time of the year, and I'm super grateful to just be a part of that rhythm and to be back in touch with that rhythm, because, you know, in Western society, oftentimes it's easy to, you know, get distracted by, you know, work or at least have our focus and attention on, you know, work and as that sort of thing. And sometimes, you know, I find that, at least for myself, we can miss the parts of life that make it real magical, you know, like the mystery of life. And I just, I'm just grateful that, you know, I'm kind of starting to be more in touch with that again. And just being in touch with the rhythms of the year. I'm not saying that winter is bad or anything. Winter has its own, and, you know, really cool rhythm. But it is nice to have a little bit of a break from the dreary, the gray skies and stuff, and have some of that sunshine and warmth come back, and watching the plants grow and stuff. So, anywho, so I'm going to continue with this show. And apologies, this is the third attempt that I've made, or I've tried to record this show, or this particular episode, and it's just like, I think I did record it, but my memory card was full, so it didn't save. So I made the recording yet last week, and then I checked it, and I'm just like, where is it? And then I got the message on my memory card that it was full, and I was just like, oh no. So, because I just have like a window of time where I can do these podcasts. So if I miss it, then it's like I have to wait another week, and I've kind of already been a little bit kind of behind with it, so I apologize for that. But this show, I'm going to be focused on continuing my discussion of the book Beyond the Box, which is about B.F. Skinner and his behaviorism and like behavior technology. And I'm going to, last show I talked about token economics and how it got started, or how it kind of, a lot of experiments and programs, they're called also contingency management programs. A lot of those were run through the prison system. So schools, prisons, mental institutions, and so on were they were areas in society where a lot of these experiments in behavior technology and token economics were taking place. And so, yeah, I kind of focused on that for the last couple of episodes. And now this episode, I'm just going to be focusing on, the chapter is a bit smaller, so the show might not be as long as some of the other ones, but it's a chapter that's focused on how the Skinnerian principles influenced or kind of found their way into the self-help industry. And so I'm just going to go over what I usually like to do for my shows is I like to go over and kind of just talk about the chapter, especially if it's more of an academic book. Like if it's a story, then I don't really do this. But if it's more of an academic book like this one, I'll go through the chapters and just kind of talk about some of the key points in the chapters and give my my thoughts on them. I kind of relate them to current events, like I said before. And this chapter is very similar to that. And without further ado, I'm going to begin talking about the kind of behavior principles in self-help. And I hope that, I hope you kind of learn something from it. I'm going to leave a link to the book in the description. I think there might be a free version of it online, like if you like reading ebooks, there might be a free one on Archive, I think. So I'll check it out, and then I'll link it in the description, because just with there's so much information in these chapters, I'm often not able to, you know, talk about everything. And so I'll leave a link in the description, so that if you're interested in reading the book and learning a bit more about it, then you could check out, I think there is a free version of it online. And then I'll leave a link. It's a Canadian press or a Canadian company that publishes the book, and I'll leave a link to that in case you want to add it to your library. Okay. So the first part of the chapter talks about how Skinner managed his own behavior. So Skinner was a big fan in using his behavior analysis to manage his own behavior. He tried to set up an environment for behavior success with gadgets and, you know, all these sorts of bits and bytes that he kind of set up around his house. And when I was reading this chapter, I got the impression that, you know, he wanted to, like, because he also wrote a book, and actually in the next show I'm going to be talking about it a little bit, because it's kind of an important part of that chapter, Walden 2, where he kind of wrote a book about a dystopia, or it was like a futuristic book where it was a planned community that people were living in, and a lot of behavior modification and behavior technology evolves using, well, using technology and sensors and equipment and actuators and so on to manage the environment, to manage our behavior. And so it's not as surprising that, you know, he would have all these gadgets around his house to help manage his own behavior. And I mean, on the surface of it, I don't have a problem with that. What people decide to do in their own homes, like, that's their business. If, you know, if they want to have a gadget for their toaster or something, or like a little, I mean, I have an alarm clock, so I guess that would be a type of behavior technology to get me out of bed so I could get to work on time. But the problem is that, or where I have a concern is, you know, this behavior technology being rolled out for everybody. And through token economics and blockchain, someone who's done a lot of really important research on this, her name is Allison McDowell, and I'll link to her blog post or her website, Wrenching the Gears, and she's done quite an extensive amount of research on token economies and blockchain and why it's really important to understand what they are and to learn about them and to learn about Web3, because oftentimes, you know, when we talk about like the technology that's coming, a lot of people focus on AI. And AI, yes, it's part of it. And yes, there's important conversations to have about AI, what that means to for human beings and what that means for actually all life on the planet. Where I would encourage you to expand that and to think about the other technologies that Web3 is trying to roll out, and that includes token economies and blockchain. And so token economies and blockchain are kind of focused on behavior management, so, you know, we could be, I guess, you know, whoever is setting up the rules, like an ideal citizen or something. And actually, you know, Allison and a few others have been talking about how there's this kind of drive to manage consciousness, like human consciousness, but not just human consciousness, actually all living beings' consciousness. There's this attempt, and I've talked about before on some of my other shows, where you know, the system wants to kind of create this fake world consciousness and manage and control it, which is different from the natural cosmic consciousness, what I would call cosmic consciousness, where, you know, if you want to call that energy God or goddess or the universe or creator, whatever, you know, word you use to describe that energy, that's natural. Like, that, you know, we all have a connection to that, and that's not what I'm talking about with this technology. I'm talking about like a fake world consciousness that that the system of this, you know, system of predatory system, which is something that John Trudeau, the late John Trudeau, talked about as trying to superimpose on society. So, you know, kind of relating that back to the book, like, token economies are behavior technology, and it was created out of behavior analysis, and so that's why I'm talking about that. And again, if people wanted to have their own gadgets and do these things amongst themselves but not impose that on other people, then fine, whatever, you know, I wouldn't have an issue with it. I think what but where I'm concerned is that it's, you know, they're going to try and push it onto everybody else, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of this, and I don't think a lot of people are aware of the implications of it. So I'm going to be going into that as I go along in this show and just kind of talk about that. But I mean, I talk about other subjects as well, but I think this is a really important topic to include in my shows, just because it's something that, again, not a lot of people are aware of it, and it could end up changing. Like, they'll attempt it. I don't think they'll be successful, but it could, you know, end up changing, changing up society in a way that maybe we don't want, or in a way that harms people, especially poor people, Black, Indigenous, and people that have just been pretty much taken advantage of by empire. So that's why I think this is important. That's why I'm talking about this. So to get back to the chapter, also what was interesting, as I was reading the first part of the chapter, I noticed that B.F. Skinner, he was at odds with cognitive and humanistic approaches to psychology. I don't know if he was like against like Jungian psychology or anything like that, but he felt more that you could solve behavior with, with behavior engineering by controlling the environment, and a lot of like behaviorists kind of think like that as well. And I also want to reiterate that I don't think that, you know, all these, you know, behaviorists and people are bad. I think there's a lot of people that are well-intentioned, and maybe they just don't know either that this is kind of being rolled out. Like, I think a lot of people aren't aware of that, so I just want to make sure that, you know, I'm not saying that everyone that participates in this is bad. What I'm saying is that, you know, we should really have these conversations and think about things for a minute before going forward with this. And I don't think this subject matter or some of these topics can just be left up to philosophers or like philosophy departments and universities, because I don't even know if they know what's going on, kind of thing. So I think this is a discussion for people to have, no matter what your background is. And so, yeah, so I just wanted to also put that out there as well. Okay, so to continue the chapter, the behavior analysis, back then wondered if their psychology of behavior would work in everyday life. They wondered if something like timeout would work, which worked in the psych ward, would also be something parents could use in the home. They also argued that people have been using behavior modification since forever, so why not teach people how to use these principles? And it's interesting because these methods were developed in the lab and people trusted them more because of the science. That also kind of reminds me of, you know, another kind of trend in society where, because it's associated with science, that it's automatically good. You know, I think it's important to have some critical thinking and to think about where a lot of this stuff is coming from. And that does require some research and understanding, but it's like, if you don't do the research, then you don't have the vocabulary or the understanding for what's going on, and so you're kind of vulnerable. And so I think that, you know, if you're listening to this, just, when they say, like, trust the science, like, they've been saying that for a long time, so it's not like a recent thing in history, but when they say that, just, you know, I'd encourage you to kind of think critically about that and to think about where this stuff comes from. Like, ancestry is important, and ancestry isn't just our own bloodline or where we come from, but it's also where ideas come from, right? And who thought of them, and how they take shape, and how they grow and stuff like that. Like, looking into the ancestry of something kind of helps understand like what the intentions are, and perhaps where these ideas are going and that sort of thing. So looking into the background of something, or looking into maybe who the founders are, can help with just understanding how we kind of got here in society and where we're going. And, you know, should we possibly change course? You know, maybe that idea has outgrowing, or maybe we've outgrown it, or maybe we need to think about changing course, or as Allison has said, change frequency, and think about something else. So I'd also encourage you to look into the ancestry of things and where they came from. And then to continue, so behaviorists wanted to focus more on functional relationships between a person's behavior and their immediate environment rather than historical understanding and current interpretations of the environment. So I think that, again, that kind of relates to the cognitive and humanist psychologies and how maybe a lot of behaviorists at that time, they kind of wanted to distance, or it just seems that they wanted to, some of them wanted to distance themselves from that. And so the behaviorists wanted to focus on managing and changing the environment to get the desired behavior. They wanted to also train people on how to be their own behavior analysis. And, that's how they took behavior engineering from the lab into the wider society. And it does end up finding its way into the self-help industry. So in the 1970s, behaviorist principles were applied to a number of personal behaviors like overeating, lack of assertiveness, fears, phobias, poor study habits, smoking, parenting. And then also in the 70s, the language of behaviorism started to appear in wider society. So words like positive and negative reinforcement, I've heard of those, self-control, stimulus generalization, stimulus control, and aversive consequences and functional relationships those words ended up finding their way into the wider society. And it's interesting when I look at the personal behaviors that behaviorist principles were applied to, they overlap with a lot of the health and wellness stuff that's going on. And Allison McDowell has done quite a lot of research. And actually there's other researchers too, like Jason Bosch and Leo Serencino have also done research on this. And I'll post to their blogs in the description, where they talked about how, like with token economies and blockchain, a lot of that will, a lot of token economies will be tied into the health and wellness. So to manage people's behavior, let's say overeating or, I don't know so much about smoking anymore, but let's say poor study habits, the token economy is being set to be tied in with that. So if you're doing, if you're, let's say you do overeat, or let's say you do have poor study habits, like there'll be tokens set up that, if you perform a certain behavior, if you do a certain thing, then you'll get these tokens. And the intention is to kind of have tokens as a monetary system. I don't know if they're going to completely abolish cash and debit and credit cards, but they're going to use, they'll definitely include more and more token economies in the wider society. So it won't be just like confined to one thing like cryptocurrencies, because they are a form of a token economy. So, they're going to try and roll that out to the wider society. And I don't think most people are aware of that. And it's not going to be really a choice either. So, in order to, let's say, get your UBI or whatever it is, like your money for the month, and you'll have to perform these behaviors in order to get those tokens. So it's not really a voluntary thing. If it was voluntary, and if certain people, volunteered to do it while everyone else is left alone, again, that's not something I'd have an issue with. But what I have an issue is that it's the involuntary nature of forcing people to engage with these tokens in order to manage their behavior towards some sort of some sort of equilibrium for some sort of fake consciousness, because that's like the deeper part of it. But the surface part is like the using tokens to manage people's behavior. And there is a financial aspect to it, and I might go into it a bit more detail, but Allison and Leo have both written quite a bit about that, like human capital finance and so on. So that's like a whole other subject. And I think maybe, you know, doing another show on that would probably be good, but just know for now that there is some token economies being ready to roll out for all of the rest of society to manage our health and wellness. So I'll just kind of leave it at that for now. And then just to continue with the book, they did do, during the 70s, they also did do experiments where they used behaviorist principles to see if they could help people with overeating. So, and actually, one of the first problems behaviorists wanted to tackle at that time was overeating. And even now, like, obesity is a big topic now, along with diabetes. So it hasn't gone away. It's like that focus has been around since at least the 70s, maybe even before. The behaviorists thought weight loss was tied more so to arranging environmental contingencies and not so much on will. So in 1965, Dr. Charles Furster received a letter from a psychiatric nurse who used operant conditioning to control her eating. A few years prior, Furster wrote an article on overeating and strategies people could use to control this behavior. The article came as a result of an experiment where people, you know, nurses, wanted to lose weight, and Furster created an experiment to do that. And again, if like people wanted to use this stuff on an individual basis to improve a part of their life or change a habit, like that's not the concern I have. The concern I have is using behaviorist principles for everybody when that might not necessarily be appropriate. And there have been problems with abuse and, you know, people with maybe nefarious intentions using behaviorism to hurt vulnerable people, like kids with autism, people with psychiatric or mental illness and so on. So it has happened. And so that's also another concern I have about this stuff. Okay, so the overeating experiment had four steps to it. So the first step was determine variables that influence eating. And then the second step was determine how to manipulate those variables, followed by identify unwanted adverse consequences, and finally arrange a method to develop self-control. The program wasn't about developing willpower or some sort of internal quality. He focused on arranging the environment and manipulating conditions to reduce chances of the problem behavior from happening. So nurses were asked to do a number of things at the beginning of the program. So they talked about and wrote down consequences of overeating. They were encouraged to think about when they experienced a temptation to overeat, like to when they think about it, to write it down. They kept a daily log of what they ate and what the calorie intake was. And then they followed a maintenance diet so they could practice self-control before losing weight. And then they wouldn't overeat when deprived of calories. The nurses were also taught stimulus control, so they engaged in competing activities like a walk when they felt the urge to eat. The nurses also engaged in using station effects. So I guess that's more of an example of that would be like a housewife meal prepping right before or right after lunch rather than later in the day to avoid nibbling. So then I guess you avoid overeating. So while the early program for controlling overeating didn't go off the ground, it interested other behaviorists who attempted to create their own programs. So, it's been going on for quite a while, too. Like, there's other programs and stuff like that out there for overeating. So it just kind of goes to show how behaviorism has kind of crept into the self-help industry and the wider society. Another example that the author uses in the book for like a so-called problem behavior is assertiveness. So, in the 1970s, a book on assertiveness called Your Perfect Right, A Guide to Assertive Behavior by Robert Alberti and Michael Emmons was published. I hope I said that right. They thought you could use behavior modification principles to be more assertive. They tried to include behavior principles into popular humanist psychology, such as self-actualization and personal growth. And I found that kind of interesting because maybe not all behaviorists thought that cognitive and humanistic psychologies were at odds with behaviorism. Later in the, on, as I was reading that chapter, it looked like there was certain behaviorists that felt that, behavior principles could be included with the other topics in psychology, so they weren't as extreme in dismissing cognitive and humanist psychology as, like, say, Skinner was. So not everybody, was thought the same way as him within the behaviorist community. And so the behaviorists, they talked about practicing new patterns of behavior and not just willpower alone, or waking up one day and deciding you'll be assertive from now on. The readers were asked to log their own behavior in a diary, so similar to like those that were struggling with overeating, and set small, manageable goals, and manage appropriate assertive responses and rehearse them and practice them in role playing. And having a program of reinforcement was important to keep these new behaviors going, because it is a problem that I noticed when reading the other chapters in the book, is that if the token economies or kind of like the environmental stuff that they were using to kind of control behavior goes away, the people usually end up reverting back to their, like, I guess what you'd call it as the baseline behavior. So they have to be continually in place for people to continue this new habit that that society or whatever is trying to create for themselves. And again, like, if on an individual level, if people find that behaviorism can help with assertiveness, then that's great. But I just don't think it's something that needs to be pushed onto the wider society. And then in the book, the author also talks about how a lot of behaviorists wanted to encourage, were trying to encourage people to be their own behavior modifiers. The author of Beyond the Box thinks behavior modification is a completely transferable technology. Like Gary Martin and Joseph Pear wrote a general how-to book called Behavior Modification: What It Is and How to Do It. They also emphasize that behavior is controlled by the environment and not by willpower. Bad contingencies and reinforcements in the environment is what leads to bad behavior. In the case of self-control, the individual person is responsible for setting up and carrying out the program. And I kind of got confused by this whole thing about free will versus self-control. Like, to me, they sound like it's something. Something that's similar to each other, because wouldn't you need to have the willpower to stay self-controlled, even if the environment's like manipulated to reduce a behavior? You still need to be have exercise some willpower. So I don't I kind of got confused about that. Like, I feel like willpower, it is important to develop willpower and discipline, and those are kind of internal qualities that I think we can nurture within ourselves. And I don't know, maybe willpower and self-control kind of overlap with each other. So I don't know, I kind of got a little confused about that. And then to behaviorists like Skinner, they thought that the self is not an agent. So they thought that if you want to change a specific behavior, then design the environment to enable that change. Know thyself, know the environment, and know the relationship between them was like a major theme with Skinner and behavior principles or behaviorist principles. Skinner defined the act or defined the self as a functional unit unified set of responses. He argues society is where self-control came from, not the self. And he gave the example of that society can deter alcoholism, even though that hasn't really happened. Alcoholism is a big problem. Skinner thought the individual has very little control within society, and that society has the ultimate control. That's not true. And from a metaphysical standpoint, if you ever read anything on esoteric science, like, you know, whether it's Rudolf Steiner's work or whoever, oftentimes, well, actually, this comes from Hermeticism, which comes out of Kemet, which is currently called Egypt. And there's the principle of the micro and the macro world. And yes, the macro world, you know, the society around us, it does influence us, but then it's vice versa. When we begin, when we do the inner work on ourselves to heal and grow as spiritual beings, that sends out a ripple into the wider society, and it begins to change that. So it's a two-way street. It's not society always causing or always controlling the individual. It's a relationship. And, you know, that's not really talked about in Western society, but in other cultures and other spiritual traditions, that is talked about and understood. So, and also too, like the wider society, you know, Western society is built on a lot of imperialism and colonialism, which has at its, like, control. And, like, a really good author to check out is Stephen Newcomb in Pagans in the Promised Land. I'll put a link in this description for that. And he talks about the psychology of colonialism and, like, the cognitive psychology and, you know, words like control and controlling the environment and dominion and domination and so on, like that very much a part of the dominator mindset that came out of Western imperialism and colonialism, and it's still here. So I don't buy this thing that society has the ultimate control. We're in relationship, and you know, Western relationship or Western society hasn't had a very good relationship with the rest of the world for a long time. And I think reflecting on that would be a wise thing to do. You know, especially as Pluto, I think North America is in its Pluto return still. I could be wrong, I have to check that out. But these discussions are important. And so that's where, again, like, I don't really buy into the behaviorist stuff, because too much, again, if people want to do it on as individuals, that's fine. But for the wider society, just because there's already been so much domination and control over others and vulnerable people for a long time now, like, it's, I don't know, I think it's time to start looking at healing and having discussions about colonialism and what we can do to heal as a people, you know, and what we need to, how we can kind of peacefully find other ways to be in the world rather than this. I think that's actually quite important, and it's something that I want to talk about as my show goes on, kind of thing. All right, so I'm almost done the book, so I just have a few more, because I have some slides, so I try and, like, organize my stuff, my notes on slides, so just have a couple of more. So behavior modification was thought to do well in self-help because everyone could be their own behavior modifier, so no need for therapists. Well, we still have therapists. They transformed self-help into self-control. To help yourself, you need self-control. And that's true. That's not necessarily, you know, even the dog agrees. That's, you know, that is true. And so it was self-help was no longer about willpower, resolve, self-restraint, or impulse control. It was about controlling the environment to get the desired behavior. The author credits the behaviorist foray into the self-help industry with the creation of a language that helped to define what behavior modification was for both practitioners and the public, and have it be its own separate self-help subject. And applied behavior analysts really began to enter the public discourse, or analysis really began to enter the public discourse in the 1970s as behavior modification and linguistically codified practices that weren't talked about began finding their ways into society. And I did kind of give a list of, you know, a small list of an example of words and kind of languages or vocabulary that was starting to show up in society, and they're still here, especially positive and negative reinforcement. And then just to conclude, so self-help, or self-control rather than self-help, became an exercise in contingency management rather than just willpower. Self-awareness became self-observation, where people recorded the frequency of the behavior and its controlling variables. Behavior modification became an identifiable and distinct set of principles that garnered both praise and condemnation. So there was people, and just like now, there was people that, you know, thought it was a great way to help people, and then there's people that thought maybe it was a way to, for maybe something that they could use for ill intention purposes. Not everyone's like that, though. And then there's probably some people, like now, like myself, that maybe have some concerns about, you know, having these behaviors principles and behavior technology being pushed onto the wider society. And again, like token economics is the big example that I'm talking about with this. So that concludes this chapter. I will be talking about the next chapter next week, and I'm going to kind of finish that off and also conclude it, because there's not much left in the book. And then after that, I have started reading the fifth book in Madeline Ingalls' Time Quintet, and it's called An Acceptable Time. It, so far, is really enjoyable. It's really cool. And I really enjoy her book, or her series, The Time Quartet, or Quintet. So I just wanted to finish off that her time series before I move on to another set of stories. I'm not sure what I'm going to do after that, but I'll figure it out. In the meantime, though, thank you for stopping by the cafe. I hope you got something out of this episode, and if you did enjoy this, please consider subscribing, and I hope you check out the book. I'll make sure, like I said before, I'll have a link in the description for it, and I hope you have a blessed week and a blessed weekend, and thank you for stopping by the cafe. Bye-bye.